For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good morning and welcome. So last Sunday I spoke about the Eightfold Path, especially right view, the first part of the Eightfold Path, but the Eightfold Path is maybe the earliest, one of the earliest lists of practices, part of the Four Noble Truths. The Eightfold Path is the practices for relieving suffering, for ending suffering. There are many of these lists. This morning and tomorrow evening, I want to talk about the 10 bodhisattva practices, paramitas, or 10 transcendent practices. I want to talk about these as a background for the practice period, a practice commitment period that's starting next Sunday with an all-day sitting, but whether or not you're formally doing that practice period, we'll be talking the next couple of months about the traditional archetypal bodhisattva figures, each of whom has a particular combination of these bodhisattva practices and a particular approach and strategy towards bodhisattva practice. So I wanted to just review and talk about some of those practices, some this morning and some tomorrow evening. So these are, so the bodhisattva is the practitioner, the being, in the case of the archetypal bodhisattvas, the great celestial bodhisattvas who are available in the world, who help support universal liberation. At the end of each of the of our talks, we chant the four bodhisattva vows. So these practices are practices done by the great bodhisattvas and also are guidances for us to how to practice in the world. They're expressions of the awareness that we come to through sustained engagement in zazen, in meditation practice. And then they're reflections of that. They're expressions of zazen. And then they are ways to actually practice, actual programs of practice even, to engage in the world. And guidance is for us in that. We also talk about the 16 bodhisattva precepts, which are another system of guidances. But today I want to talk, today and tomorrow, I want to talk about these 10 bodhisattva practices. And again, the great bodhisattvas engage in them. But also, these are practices for us. So often there's a list of six, but there's a longer list of 10, which we'll talk about. So I'll just start by just naming them, and I'll give the Sanskrit name for those interested in that, but also what they mean in English. And then I'll talk about two or three of them this morning, and then we'll have some discussion. So first is dana, or generosity, giving. In each of these, and I'll come back to that one, this is the first one, is a subtle practice. A difficult practice. And I've talked about all of these before, but there's no end to engaging in these practices. Each of them is very subtle and challenging. Second is Shila, which is ethical conduct, and this is the realm of precepts and how we function in the world, and also very challenging. The third, very important, is Kshanti, or patience, which is a dynamic practice, not a passive practice, but active, kind of active patience. The fourth is virya, or effort, or enthusiasm, energy. So there will not be a test, but I just want to go over all of these. And how to, so Virya has to do with how do we sustain our energy or enthusiasm for practice or for engagement in the world. Also challenging, important practice. The fifth is samadhi, or sometimes it's listed as jhana, but it refers to meditation. Not exactly the same as the zazen we've just been doing. The zazen in the tradition of Dogen in the Soto school is kind of just open sitting, just sitting. The fifth of these paramitas refers to an aspect of our zazen, which is settling and calming and settling our mind, finding some stability in our life. The sixth of these paramitas, and often they're just, most commonly you'll probably find them in Zen talked about just in terms of these six, is prajna paramita. So I'm going to talk about that one more today. Prajna is wisdom or insight. The Heart Sutra and the Diamond Sutra, and there are whole bunches of different sutras that are named for this prajna paramita, this perfection of wisdom, this practice of wisdom or insight. So there's a prajna paramita sutra in 8,000 lines, and in the Diamond Sutra is shorter than that. Then there's a longer one that's prajna paramita in 100,000 lines. Anyway, this perfection of wisdom or insight is very important. But then I'll mention the four others: pranidhana, vow or commitment, also important. Upaya, very important. Skillful means, how to practice skillfully in the world. Bala, or powers, which sometimes refers to special meditative powers, like the Buddha brings forth, but also practically for us, how we use our abilities. And then the last one is jnana, knowledge, which is different from prajna. So it's actually useful in terms of talking about prajna. Knowledge is knowledge of how things work. And all of you have some knowledge of some area, some skill that you have developed. And that can be used to support bodhisattva aims, the bodhisattva vows to help liberate all beings, to aim towards universal liberation, or just to help relieve suffering where you see it in front of you. Including, of course, the difficulties we each face on our own seats, our own internal problems. So these bodhisattva practices, again, are practices of these great bodhisattva figures that I'll start talking about next week, but they're around us: Manjushri, the bodhisattva of wisdom, Kanon or Avalokiteshvara, the bodhisattva of compassion, and many others who are around in the temple and are part of the iconography of East Asian Buddhism and are invoked in our Zen liturgy. But just to talk about these practices today, and just to start talking about them, I want to say a little bit. I'll start by talking about dana, which we talk about, we've talked about before. But again, it continues to be always a challenge for us. What does it mean to give? What is generosity? How do we find our spirit of generosity? How do we not cling to self, but actually try to be helpful to others? So one of the ways to see bodhisattva practice, this practice of working towards universal liberation, not just practicing for ourselves, although of course we derive benefits ourselves from doing this practice regularly. We find some steadiness, we find some calm, or we can sometimes, not always, sometimes we we are benefited by seeing how our mind is whirling around, or we see more clearly our own grasping or anger or confusion. This is very available. And it's also available in the world, and the bodhisattva idea is that we're connected to the world. We can't just liberate ourselves personally without considering what's going on in the world around us, what's happening with our friends and family and loved ones and in the world. So generosity is to start to see how to be caring and generous for others. But also the practice for generosity for monks in traditionally in Asia is to receive. So when I was in the monastery in Kyushu in Japan, we would go on begging rounds. This is the traditional practice. And it's like sesshin for your feet and your voice. You go and spend the day walking on straw sandals, and until you get used to them, there's, you know, your toes or your heels bleed, and you're chanting as you go from house to house. And I hung up my straw sandals in the Doksan room because I'm not doing that anymore. But we still have a Dana bowl asking for generosity. So for us to learn to give, we also need to learn to receive. How do we accept the generosity of others? So we talk in our meal chant about the three wheels, giver, receiver, and gift. The practice of generosity is a practice of mutuality. We start to feel the reality of our interconnectedness with all beings through giving. So there's, you know, just the simple level of how do you give an appropriate gift? So when it's a time for gift giving, what's something that's actually an appropriate gift for someone? Or, you know, how do you receive a gift graciously? Maybe it's not the gift you would like. Maybe it's not something you... maybe it's something that you feel is... What? I don't want that. But how do you then, you know, receive it graciously? And maybe actually it is... You might find it's useful for you. I don't know. So giving is a challenge. How to be generous. How to actually be generous. And, of course, part of the practice of the paramitas is to see how they're connected. So... Each of these practices is supported by all the others. So, generosity is supported, for example, by skillful means, by learning how to be skillful. Generosity is supported by patience, by watching. Well, if you want to give something to someone, if you decide you really care about someone and you want to give them something, you have to watch and see what is it that would be really helpful to them. They may not even know what would be helpful to them. If you want to receive something graciously, so prajna and dana are related too, and I'll talk more about prajna. How do you see what's in front of you? Study that allows you to practice generosity in a new way? And so there are many challenges to generosity. And this is something that, you know, all of these are practices that all of you have already been doing. These are not new practices. All of you have, well, maybe I shouldn't assume. Is there anyone here who's never received a gift? Don't be shy. It's okay. And if you raise your hand, you may find that many people are going to start giving you something here. Is there anybody here who's never given a gift? Okay, so we all know about about generosity and gift giving. We all have some practice of that. And you know, sometimes it just comes naturally. We just, oh yeah, okay, I'll give this to this person. Or you know, it's not just giving material objects. So when we do the begging rounds, there's a chant that we do when we go door to door, and sometimes you do it at a public place, like a bridge or a train station or something. But also going door to door, there's a chant you do and in Asia, the lay people want to give to the monks to support their spiritual practice. They feel they get some benefit from that, and there's a whole culture around that. So it's a different way of seeing it. Here, beggars are seen as, you know, bums, and you know, we have trouble giving handouts to panhandlers on the street or homeless people on the street. They're seen as, you know, not worthy, you know, and we wonder, oh, what are they going to use it for? You know, there's one version of that the Bodhisattva, actually Jizo, the earth storehouse Bodhisattva, who we'll talk about, and Kanon, the Bodhisattva of compassion, both sometimes hold a gift bestowing jewel, and the practice of that is just to give whatever anybody asks for. So, you know, that's beyond questions of, well, what is this person going to do with the money I might give them? Are they going to use it for drugs or alcohol or, you know? You just give, and maybe that encourages someone. I'm not saying that that's what we should do. It's not, this is a question always. There's also the question that people with resources face, how to give in a way that's effective, that's helpful, where to give, who to give to, where to give. So, but I was starting to say that there's a chant that's done after one receives something when you're going from door to door, that is about it's about giver, receiver, and gift, but it's about the oneness of giving material gifts and spiritual gifts. So there's a chant that's about that's given as teaching. So now I'm giving teaching about the paramitas. That's considered a kind of gift. But also you're receiving it. So that's also a kind of gift. You're giving me the opportunity to give some teaching. And Dogen says in one of his talks that Buddhas sometimes sit up in the front and give teaching. Buddhas also sit and listen to the teaching. This is what Buddhas do. So listening to the teaching and giving teaching are equally Buddha practices. So there's this mutuality, there's this circularity about giving and receiving that is part of the heart of this practice of generosity, of dana. And it's a subtle practice. So there's a lot more to say about that. But I'll talk about prajna a little bit, and then maybe we can have some discussion, and I can talk some more about some of the others too. But prajna paramita, so is the sixth, and in some sense is a circle, because then it goes back to dana paramita. Again, often there's just the six. So prajna is often translated as wisdom. We chant on Wednesday mornings the Heart of Perfect Wisdom Sutra, the Heart Sutra. But it's a particular kind of wisdom. Well, it may include many kinds of wisdom. So the Bodhisattva of wisdom, Manjushri, who always usually sits in the center of Zen meditation halls, and there's a Manjushri figure sitting below Shakyamuni on the altar, riding a lion with a teaching scepter. Sometimes he carries a sword to cut through delusion. But wisdom also could be translated as insight, to see clearly, and it means seeing within. So it's about meditative wisdom in a sense. Manjushri is associated with meditation, to look and see clearly. So we sit facing the wall in our tradition, which is to say we sit facing ourselves. And thoughts and feelings arise, and and then we let go of them, and they may come up again. But we see what's in front of us. Whatever in our zazen practice, whatever arises, we just see it. This practice of insight is to see what's in front of us, and we develop this practice of just being able to witness clearly what's in front of us. And so this practice of wisdom or insight is to see in any situation. So facing the wall is to see our own hearts and minds. It's also to see our connectedness to all beings. It's not a wall to keep anything out or anybody out. But prajna is wisdom or insight into the heart of things, into what's important. It's not about knowledge. Again, there's a different practice that's knowledge. So wisdom isn't really about, you know, studying lots of sutras or listening to lots of Dharma talks. It's true that in Asian cultures, students will go and make offerings to Manjushri to do well on tests and things like that. So popularly, it's understood in various ways. But really, this prajna is clear seeing. What's important? So Suzuki Roshi, my teacher's teacher, used to say, what's the most important thing? And we could say that globally, or we could just say, right now, what's the most important thing? In this situation, so in whatever situation we're in, some difficulty with someone at work, some difficulty that we have to respond to in our life, or with a family member, or whatever, prajna is about what's the insight into what's going on here. So seeing clearly. Now this is supported, of course, by samadhi, by being settled enough to see clearly, by patience, by being able to just watch, by energy, by having this energy to stay with it. So all of these, again, they all interact with each other. And that's part of what we'll see when we're looking at the bodhisattvas. They each have a combination of particular paramitas that they particularly express. But prajna is to look into the heart of things. And prajna also is associated with the teaching of emptiness, which is particular Buddhist teaching. So emptiness doesn't mean nothingness. So this is a technical aspect of this teaching of prajna. We're going to be working on these different bodhisattvas from this book, Faces of Compassion, about the classic bodhisattva archetypes, a book that I wrote. But I'm just going to read a little bit about wisdom and emptiness. Prajna, or wisdom, is the experiential insight into the essential emptiness or insubstantial nature of all phenomena. So to see what's happening in any situation is to see, in a way, to see its emptiness. But what does that mean? All material and mental events are fundamentally empty, void, and vast as space. This emptiness does not mean vacancy or non-being in a nihilistic sense. Rather, in the nature of their very existence, all things are empty of any independent, substantial quality and are not separate and estranged from the totality of all being and each other. So another way to translate emptiness might be relativity. So prajna, or wisdom, is to see how things are totally interrelated, whatever situation is happening, to look into it and to see how it is part of a web of many causes and conditions. Prajna is the experience of the essential unity and sameness of all things in the midst of their diversity. All things appear and finally cease. All of us will pass away. In spite of all the distinctions we cherish, all people are alike in having fears, needs, and desires, in wanting to love and to be loved. This penetrating insight into the oneness and emptiness of all creation is embodied in the Bodhisattva Manjushri, as I've said, who eloquently cuts through and opens up each of the delusions of our discriminating consciousness. The awakening to this insight slices through the confusions of our conditioning, which habitually obstruct our life and awareness. So part of insight is to see the way in which we are caught by our habits of thinking, to see our patterns. So part of Zazen, maybe the most difficult part of Zazen, is to see our patterns of grasping or anger or confusion coming up again and again and again, to get familiar with them, to study the self, as Dogen says, to know what we're up to get used to that, and then not be caught by it, so we don't need to react to it. So we can say, oh yeah, there's that again, and then not act it out. Emptiness is not a thing, some new toy or crutch to grab hold of. The greatest delusion warned against by masters of emptiness teaching is attachment to emptiness. Even emptiness is empty. It's simply a way of being that releases and lets go of attachments. It is a practice of opening and letting go. So, prajna is about seeing into what's happening, seeing how it's related to many things, seeing that our ideas and stories about what's happening are not the whole story. Looking deeply. And it's a kind of an immediate thing. It's not about something we have to figure out. So Manjushri is often depicted as a 16-year-old. Teenagers often know clearly. We've seen this weekend in terms of the young people speaking truth to power about the politicians and the gun lobbies and what's needed for sanity in our culture. So it's kind of an immediate clear seeing, and yet it includes all of this seeing into our confusion. So I could say a lot more about prajna or about generosity and these other practices of enthusiasm and settling and ethical conduct of commitment. But maybe I'll stop there and ask for comments or questions about any of these practices. So questions, comments, responses, please feel free. Yes, Dylan.
I have a question. So if everything is inherently empty and none of us are actually separate from one another, then how is it possible to give some of the maybe that they didn't work out?
Well, it's not, because we already have everything, but we don't know it. So we're all connected, but also we're all distinct. So emptiness is about this essential sameness, but particularly in our, well, in East Asian Buddhism generally, but also in our tradition, we talk about the harmony of difference and sameness. There is this aspect of prajna, of the oneness, sameness, connectedness of all of us. But each of us expresses that in a particular way. I can see you and Jerry, and in some ways you're the same, in some ways you're quite distinct. So how do we respond to that? From the heart that is the same. So when Dogen came back from his study in China and he was asked what he brought with him, he just said, eyes horizontal, nose vertical. We all share that. But then we each have our own particular way of expressing it, and that's wonderful. So in some ways we do have a self, but it's not the self we think of as a separate self. It's the self that's the expression, a particular expression of the commonality of all of us. So it's subtle. So ask your question again.
If none of us are truly separate and everything is inherently empty, then how do we give someone anything that they didn't already have?
Right. So to show somebody what they already have, to help, not just to show them, but to help somebody express what they already have in their way. So I can't tell you how to be Buddha, but I can help you see how the Buddha that's already under your seat can grow and develop and express itself through you. And that's an ongoing process. That's not something that you get and then it's done, because we're alive. So in Japan, they say when somebody dies, they become hotoke, a Buddha, because they're finished, you know. But as long as we're alive, we keep having this challenge of how do we find how to express Buddha today as Dylan, as the particular being we are. It's not that it's something new, but it's responding to a new situation. It's a new season, or even if it feels like it's still as cold as it was, you know, last week. So, good luck. Other comments or questions or responses? In terms of any of these practices. Yes, Nicholas.
That last exchange just made me, I was thinking about how teaching of the two truths kind of fits into maybe understanding about this ultimate truth and conventional truth.
Yeah, ultimate truth and conventional, yeah.
Yeah, and that they exist.
We still have to do the laundry and pay the rent. Yeah, thank you. Other comments or questions? Yeah, please. Jeff, hi. Good. Welcome, welcome. Yeah, so the Heart Sutra says, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Form is no other than emptiness, emptiness is no other than form. So emptiness is not the absence of form. Emptiness is the way form is. So there's not really any difference. There we can talk about, you know, material concerns and the materialism of our society and putting things in terms of, you know, accumulating material stuff in, as opposed to accumulating, you know, friendships or something. There's not, in terms of, I think in Western religion there's this duality between matter and spirit or something like that. But I think it's not so much a part of what we're talking about here, to talk about the two truths idea of the ultimate reality and the conventional reality, the ultimate reality is right here in this physical world. It's not somewhere else. It's not in some ethereal spiritual realm in some you know, heavenly place. It's right here. It's so right after this, we will have a practice of mindful temple cleaning. So taking care of the physical dimension of our reality is an important part of our practice. So they're not really separate, to respond to your question. Other responses or questions or reflections? Hi, Miriam.
I find this very meaningful, the kind of tension between universal and individual aspects. At least for myself, I find it's a big struggle to free myself from the sense of being an individual and trying to get past that. But I find it very meaningful because it's, you know, it's to me, it's really an enormous mystery, the whole thing. And for us to try to find, you know, specific meaning in things like that. For me, to let it go, and then maybe it'll come to us instead of us.
Well, I wouldn't try to free yourself from being an individual. Just in being the individual you are expressing the universal. To see the universal as expressed uniquely by each of us, each in our own weird way, each in our own particularity, is the universal. It's not in getting rid of the self. So non-self in Buddhism doesn't mean you should not, you know, not take care of yourself. It doesn't mean that you don't, that you are not a self. It means that it's not that the self you truly are is not limited to some idea or story or set of numbers or, you know, whatever that you have about yourself, that we all start from some. I think we to survive adolescence, maybe we need to build an ego where we have stories about ourselves and who we are, and you know, and that's not it. But more fundamentally, there is an individual on your seat right now who is a wonderful, dynamic, marvelous expression of everything. So don't try and not be an individual, but how do you see that individual informed by everything? And totally expressing everything. And, you know, I've said this before, but one of the things that I, that was really most informative to me when I, after some years of practice, when I first went to San Francisco Zen Center, is that the really most senior practitioners, the people who had been with Suzuki Roshi, were each really weird. I could start naming names, but maybe I don't need to. That you know, that as we steep in the practice, we become more ourselves in some way that's not about just some story or idea, but that is a deep expression of everything. And that's not something we can manipulate or figure out or control. It's just, you know, we each have our own seat. So please allow yourself to be yourself. Maybe on that note, we'll